I always think that your data needs to be your driver, right? So if you're getting popped all the time, you're probably not aware of your tech debt. You're probably not aware of your attack surface, and you probably should be spending a lot of time there.
Welcome to the Future of Application Security, a podcast for ambitious leaders who want to build a modern and effective AppSec program. Doing application security right is really hard. Now I'm going to help you build a better future of AppSec at your company by curating the lessons from the leaders. I'm your host, Harshal Parikh, CEO of Tromso. And without further ado, let's get into it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Future of Application Security. Today, I have the phenomenal Nat Mokri with us. Nat is currently a VP of Application and Product Security at Activision Blizzard Kings. Nat, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Nat, it is such a pleasure to have you with us. And I've been waiting for this podcast recording for a long time today. But I know you. Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit to our audience? What do you do?
Yeah. So first off, it's a pleasure to be here. Apologies. That's all on me as far as being able to get time. It's been a little bit busy in our world with the acquisition. But yeah, so my world, as you said, I'm the VP of Application and Product Security. Specifically, what this means is we take a look at the security of all of our games. We take a look at the line of business applications that support our gaming environments, as well as those more traditional sort of IT-run applications and ensuring the confidentiality, integrity, and the availability of all those systems and data and all that kind of good stuff. So we had a team of about 20-some-odd people, and we range everything from threat modeling and training to testing of things as it goes through our pipelines, all the way to red team bug bounty and pen testing.
That's a pretty wide scope, considering that you're protecting some of the most used software applications across the world. Tell me a little bit about your journey. How did you get here? I mean, I play some games, my kids play a lot of games, and you know, we're putting a lot of trust in your team's hand, but how did you get here? You spent a lot of time in security. Tell us a little bit of your journey.
Yeah. So first off, gaming, I've been a lifelong gamer. I mean, I go back to, for those of you that might remember, a Fairchild system, and this is like 79, 80. And games have always been a part of my life, from even tabletop, pencil and paper type of stuff with Dungeons and Dragons and all that kind of fun stuff. I've always been fascinated with technology, even when I was in school. However, you know, before I went off to college, I was convinced there was no future in computers, right? And so I went pre-med, focused my attention on something that would be worthwhile endeavor with the military for a short stint. And when I got out of there, that passion that I had for technology transcended a job that I was doing at the time. And I was tapped by somebody to go participate in what was a support center for Safeway grocery stores. And that was probably like, gosh, almost 30 years ago. And where I started getting my focus in on doing some Unix systems management that then involved putting computers on the internet and hardening those computers. And the CISO got wind of the work that I was doing. It was like, hey, you're doing some good work there. Would you ever think about a career in security? And that was like 99. And I have never looked back. And I've been in security ever since. And so it's been a heck of a journey. I've seen a little bit of change in those years. And I'm excited to see what some of the new technology changes for our world. So
that is awesome. And can you tell a little bit about, maybe expand a little bit about what your team is focused on, maybe talk a little bit about the scope of responsibilities?
Yeah. So at the center of who we are, we talk about a lot of this, whether it be sort of operational planning or three-year sort of strategies and all that kind of good stuff. We spend a lot of time with, like, what is our calling? What is our mission at the end of the day? And what we see ourselves as the defenders of player trust, right? So the company is all about delivering epic online entertainment experiences, whether that be Call of Duty, Warcraft, Diablo, Candy Crush. We want to make sure that those experiences that those individuals have online is a safe and secure environment in which to operate. Obviously, we have a wide range number of people that play our games. I always think of it this way, is if you have somebody in a movie theater, crowded movie theater, that's talking throughout there, it disrupts everything. Well, the same thing with the community at large. If you have people that are trying to take down services or trying to do things to our backend applications that disrupts that experience, we want to prevent that as best as possible. And so we do that in a wide array of ways of protecting that player trust.
That's amazing. I love that you summarized your objective with defending player trust. That's a brilliant mission statement. A lot of times I see a lot of security teams where they're very, very good professionals, smart, talented people, but they don't have that North Star. And I'm excited that you do. Tell me a little bit about why you even came up with this mission statement, this objective of defending their trust.
Yeah, honestly, there's lots of this that goes back to my days at Amazon, which was one of the leading principles that existed there was customer obsession. And what I found fascinating with really getting focused in on the most important thing, which is the customer, everything else comes naturally, right? It also, for those individuals that may be struggling with like waking up in the morning and not understanding what they need to do on that given day, or maybe what their focus should be, is if they're working on something that either is the customer or in this case, the player, they're probably working on the right thing. So nobody has to really instruct individuals on where to go or what to work on. We always talk about is that as long as you're operating in the realm of 180 degrees of goodness, because there's 180 degrees of wrongness, right, that are this way, but the 180 degrees of goodness, right, is if you're doing something that's enhancing player trust, you're doing good stuff for the company. And we're going to naturally see the benefits of that. I think when our development community also understands that we have a mission that aligns nicely with what they're trying to do, right? Again, getting to that idea of creating great entertainment experiences online, they see us as a natural partner with them rather than that group that, hey, we're here from security, we're here to help type of thing. And so that tends to fall on deaf ears when you do that. But when they see us rolling up our sleeves and trying to improve the experience, that resonates with them. And I think it's a great way for folks to earn trust.
That's phenomenal. I think that's a great way to align everyone in a single direction and give a purpose to your daily activities. A lot of times the risk is also that everyone's excited. You write up a mission statement and you say, okay, this is what we're all aimed towards. But then it stays as a placard on the wall and people actually don't do anything about it. Do you have any things and any commentary around how do you actually make it actionable on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. Great question. And I think I will say that probably for the first maybe 6-9 months that I took on this job, you're sort of putting together the vision, the mission, and maybe some tenants, and people do the proverbial eye roll and they're like, oh God, another one of these things. But it's persistence, right? It's bringing that to the forefront every single time that you're talking about, like, what are we doing? And I created a flywheel, right? Which had player trust, like sitting at the center of that. And sort of off of that is like, how are we building paved roads and guardrails and fundamentally improving the ability to do things securely by default, right? And that shoots off of like, why are we doing that? Well, we're trying to defend player trust. And then as the business sees that happening, what they see is like, oh my God, you're actually trying to solve some of these fundamental problems. Rather than nagging us about fixing this vulnerability or this exposure here, you're actually trying to help us solve fundamental problems that we're having in being secure. Because it's not like any developer sitting out there going like, hey, how can I be insecure today, right? It's usually either they don't know how to do it, or they don't have time to do it, or it's a combination of both of those things, right? They're not actively seeking out maybe help. But if we're helping them to go down paths that are secure by default, then what they do is they start opening up the doors a little bit to us, giving us visibility into what their challenges are. As we get that visibility, we get a better understanding of what problems we can solve for them, but we also get more visibility into the risks that they're having, right? And then that sort of just starts feeding a flywheel of sorts to where we're getting more visibility, we're fixing more things, they're entrusting us more, and that cycle just perpetuates over and over and over. And then next thing you know, you're really almost like seen as an embedded team member, right?
Right.
You're getting clued in on that special project that they didn't want to tell anybody about, right? Because they might disrupt their timelines or whatever. Now you're getting into the know of like what really matters to those development teams. And that's where the magic happens.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, I think there's a lot of positive upside. You can align resources and initiatives towards that mission statement.
Yeah.
Have there been cases where the general security professional would say, well, we should do this, but then you go back to this and say, yeah, let's not do that because it's not aligned with our mission statement?
Look, first and foremost, in order to pull off any of these things, when you're trying to build this stuff, you've got to make sure that you have the right leadership in place. And I honestly, in so many ways in my career, I've been blessed to have really great leaders that have supported me and have been patient as you get these things off the ground, because what I'm describing here can be undone like in one fell swoop, And this is like one of those things where you come in heavy-handed, you start dictating to development teams what they need to do and the timelines that they need to do it, not taking in regards like all the things that they're doing. Because like, look, what was it, 2011 when Marc Andreessen said, you know, software is eating our world? Software is eating our world. It's fully consumed. I mean, if anything, AI is starting to eat that world, right? And so I think for us is we need to recognize that the talent in our organization, the revenue builders, right, is the development community. And if you don't approach that community correctly, one is that you'll just be excommunicated and they won't just engage with you, right? The other side of it is that when you do engage appropriately with that community, you start really delivering real value at the end of the day. So yes, the board of directors and having visibility into what's going on is critically important. And senior leadership and proving that there's a return on investment with the money that they've given you, right? That's critically important. But you have to go to great lengths to preserve the integrity or the trust that you've built with development teams as you demonstrate the sort of continuous improvement towards a better state. Is that going to happen in one fell swoop? I guess is what my point is.
Right. Yeah, that totally makes sense. I think a lot of times these are all very embedded, complex questions that have connotations to the culture of the company, of the business development culture. And it's very hard to synthesize the challenges of AppSec teams in one single statement that applies everywhere. So it really depends on the context of the business. I'm curious what your thought is on, in a world where software has already eaten our world and potentially coming in, what are the challenges that AppSec teams are facing today?
Wow. A lot. So talked about a couple of them, which is you have to talk to your boss and you have to get the right metrics and you have to prove that you have a return on investment. I think that's something that tends to be brushed off. And actually, I think there was a White House sort of directive to talk about how we need to have better measures in place, right? And I think this dovetails nicely with sort of the conversation here of like, how do you keep your leadership satisfied that you are improving? And I think it starts with like going through and having a real serious baselining discussion around what the capabilities in the organization are from the standpoint of developing secure software. But at the same time, while you're balancing some of those needs and proving where you are and having an honest discussion with leadership of where you are, is you need to solve real problems that the development community is having, right? And you may have an initiative that you want to, I don't know, critical vulnerability or an issue that exists in a piece of code somewhere that you need somebody to do. I always think of it as like a piggy bank of trust, right? Like for every time that you're asking somebody to do something, you're drawing on that piggy bank. Every time that you've done something for them, you're putting money into that piggy bank. And I think you need to be cognizant of that give and take, that transaction, that are you just asking dev teams to go up and do stuff, or are you helping them solve problems, right? So every time you help them, then you can ask for something. It doesn't go the other way around. You don't just to come in and start dictating things. Now, again, are there places where that does happen? Absolutely. But I just don't feel like the longevity of that leader in those types of roles, I just don't feel like there's lasting power. And what is more lasting is when you do understand the culture that you join, understand how to adapt your style. And again, you're still going to bring the same frameworks and the same testing tools and all this kind of good stuff and the structures you've used in the past, but adapt yourself to meet the needs of that new culture that you've joined and really start offering value. I think the one thing that I would say too is, and it's an annoyance for me, is this shift left. Everything is shift left. Magic's going to happen just as if we were going to shift left. And Mark Herfey wrote an article last year, and he was talking about the dangers of the myth on shifting left, right? And this, like, we all talk about the 100-to-1 savings that you get by shifting left and finding bugs earlier in the development lifecycle that IBM put out there. There is no research on this, right? And so it's been debunked that nobody ever did this research to say that these security exposures are magically solved by doing threat modeling or training. Now, I'm not saying that you don't do that. Of course you do that, right? But I think if we take it a step further, we say, like, where do you need resources? Do you need resources at the center, or what I think of as sort of the CI/CD sort of process, right? Or do I shift left? Do I bring training and threat modeling, design reviews, and all that kind of good stuff? Or do I shift right? Right? Do I bring a bug bounty in, or a red team, or a pen test? I always think that your data needs to be your driver. So if you're getting popped all the time, you're probably not aware of your tech debt. You're probably not aware of your attack surface, and you probably should be spending a lot of time there. Those are shift right types of things, right? Those are finding out, like, don't mean to go all Donald Rumsfeldian, right? But you have your known knowns and your unknown unknowns. You probably want to spend time whittling down your unknown unknowns, at least get the asset known, right? And then find out what is the security state of it, and then bring it into the fold of the known knowns. So like I said, I think that's a big one for our industry, is really understanding what the data is telling me and where do I shift my resourcing? Do I need to be more right, more left, or more in the center? And I think at the end of the day, if you're using data, you'll find that you have a balanced approach and providing assurances within your software development lifecycle.
Yeah, that's very well said, by the way. I think there is generally a lack of importance of data within the AppSec world, at least. There's not many teams that operate based on data, which is one of the reasons why we are focused so much at Tromso, focused on bringing data to the light. But anyway, the point here is that I 100% agree with you. Like, the data needs to drive decisions. And a lot of times you just don't have that data. So you got to figure that data out and make your decisions based on that. Another interesting thing that I caught up on is you mentioned you use the term piggy bank of trust. And I love it. I say, usually I follow the similar principles where you have to make deposits into your account before you start withdrawing it. The thing that's hard in this space is, as for most security teams, what is the thing that you can give back first? What is the thing that you can deposit first? And I have a few answers to that same question in my mind. But if you follow that route, that fundamentally changes the structure of your team, the mission of your security organization. Now, it's not looking like a traditional security team that does assessments and testing and files tickets. It looks different. Yeah. Tell me more about that perspective of depositing into the piggy bank before taking it out.
One of the first groups that I established in our organization was an area called the Trust Center, and have a very capable leader, Matt Clapham, who you know, and is leading that group. And really what it is, I don't know what the right term is. I want to say consulting, but that has sometimes this, I don't know, bad image that it conjures in some people's minds. I don't mean it from the standpoint of consultants coming in and telling you what to do, but rather just the type of consultant that comes in and asks the question is like, what are you struggling with? What are you having a problem? And I think so many of the times, especially we as leaders, are expected to come in with the answers, right? It's like, oh, we got to do this, 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 and this, and we just operate, right? And it's like, it doesn't work like that. Showing up and having a little bit of humility and going like, I don't know all the answers, right? I need to ask questions. I need to ask what you're struggling with, what your challenges are. More times than not, you'll have people giving you a laundry list. And what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to ruthlessly prioritize that list of things that people give you. But I just find it interesting when I talk to leaders that are like, oh, I don't know what my business's problems are. And it's like, well, did you ask them? I mean, seriously, just ask. And I'm sure that there's something that you can sink your teeth into, or you can look at it and go, yeah, you know, maybe this isn't the most important thing to the business, but this is an area where it could, if I did this for the business, which is important to them, it would get me some type of security return on that, right? And then it just sort of, you know, it's a give and take relationship that goes on in perpetuity after that. So a lot of teams, I have done this where it's, I guess, a tiger team or an away team type of model where everybody's dedicating resources on things. This is an easy one of those where you can lead an initiative and people can learn to trust you and get to know you. And through those relationships, that's where, like I said before, the magic happens.
Right. And you had earlier in one of your comments, you had mentioned building out security guardrails and engineering principles and things like that. You also consider that as a way of helping the dev teams do the right things?
So, yeah, but not to be confused with what I just talked about. Solving problems for folks versus minimizing the opportunities for them to do it wrong, two totally different things, right? And I think when we think about security by design or security by default, is like you got to consciously do something that causes the security issue rather than, oh, I forgot to do whatever, right? And I think for me, is this coincides nicely with sort of the way that I think about training. And I've gotten it wrong too, by the way, is that we spend all this time training our developers to be AppSec engineers. And I think we, for the longest time, I definitely got it wrong earlier in my career. They don't need to be AppSec engineers. What we need to do as AppSec engineers is be more like developers, right? How do we develop things? How do we develop libraries that are shared and enable security by default? How do we think about our cloud compute structures and having that be secure by default? And then our training is less about, like I said, it's like, oh, do you know what a cross-site scripting vulnerability is? So who cares? Like, you know, in the taxonomy of vulnerabilities, right? I mean, granted, we do, okay, as
right.
But developers don't. Maybe you get that one or two that really care about that. But at the end of the day, what they want to know is that, where do I go to get the thing? Or when I'm leveraging this particular pipeline, is there built-in security for me to where I don't need to worry about whether I'm using the right encryption or something along the right? So I think we as an industry need to spend a hell of a lot more time thinking about, how do we develop code that enables our developers to be secure?
Right.
And I don't think we do that enough. I think it's changing, but I don't think we're there yet as an industry.
Yeah. So Nat, then when you are building your team, forming a team,
how
do you think about structuring talent? Because these are pockets of talent that may not be consistent, right? Like, you might have somebody who's coming from a developer background, understands exactly how things work, and while somebody else might be a phenomenal red teamer and they might be able to get into stuff that nobody else could get. There's very different talent pools. So when you're thinking about building your team, what's your framework that you use for that?
Red team is an interesting thing. And so I think that's a special thing that we need to put off on the side. And the reason why I say that, not everyone does this, but I differentiate penetration testing from red teaming. Okay, when I think red teamer, I'm thinking of somebody who understands the TTPs of threat actors that exist out there and is able to emulate that adversary and really do largely red teaming to challenge your blue team on whether they have the right detection response capabilities that are in place, right? So different beast. And I'm just going to put that off to the side. But when I think of pen testing, especially in the area of application product security, is we are very much a developer-oriented group, right? I mean, tools are great, but they don't do everything for us. And so I think you're constantly building like your own set of tools and to maybe do that very niche thing that you need to do in a specific environment, or you just need to understand, like when you're trying to exploit something, is how do you reverse engineer that particular thing that's on the other side of that and understand how you might be able to write customized exploits to be able to take advantage of things. So I think at the heart of like who all of us are is, at least philosophically for me, is developers who somehow got that bug, right, to get passionate about security. I've seen groups get it wrong is when they try to convert, and this is, I'm going to paint a broad brushstroke here, and it's not always true, but for the most part is where you take a look at somebody who has been the firewall engineer, right, or somebody who has been into maybe EDR protections and all that kind of good stuff, a very important security engineering job, right? But then they sort of flip the bid on the individual and say, hey, you're going to go do AppSec. And it's like, that is a steep learning curve, right? Because you're going to have to learn all of the stuff that developers have spent, it's like back of their hand type of stuff. It's easy for them. And so what I have always said is that I would rather take a developer with no experience and teach them the security aspects of the job rather than taking somebody who is a seasoned security engineer and teaching the development side of the house. Now, again, a lot of that is changing as we start thinking about infrastructure as code. And I think you're starting to see a nice blend where everyone at least needs to be programming aware, right? At least of the basic constructs that exist there. But when it comes to like sort of where are those early to career sort of opportunities, it really is the people that have spent some time doing development and are now ready to explore a career maybe in security.
That's amazing. I love that worldview of thinking of talent, leverage skills, and build on top of it. Do you have any advice for AppSec professionals who are maybe earlier in their career, any things that they can do?
So I've mentored more than a few people, right? And many of them earlier to career, like, how do I get into this thing? I've always, for past 25 years, especially the last 10, 15 years, is when people were approaching me, like, I always just felt like, why would you want to do this? It's such a thankless job, right? We were always underappreciated. We didn't make a lot of money, but we all have this drive to make it better, to make the system better. I think that's why so many people give to like the open source community and all this kind of good stuff, just to make the ecosystem that we all live in better, right? Then all of a sudden, like within the past 5 years for sure, is that we've just seen cybersecurity salaries pop and all this kind of good stuff. I've gotten this new sort of group of individuals that have raised their hand and saying like, I'd like to understand how to get into cybersecurity. And like back in the day, it was easy. It was, which one are you? You're one of the three. Either you had a hacking background, you had an IT background or a government background, or maybe combination of the three, right? And now there's this new motivation, which I'm not used to. I just want to say to my friends that I work in cybersecurity, or I just want to make the money that's associated with cybersecurity. And what I've had to do is take a step back, because what I found is that these are people that have no interest in being technical. And I don't think you get to do that, especially with AI sort of encroaching upon our world the way that it is I think you have to have strong technical roots, right? And then you need to start learning security. You need to start learning, how do you secure something or how do you exploit something? But it starts with fundamentally understanding, how does this world that we live in operate, right? And then from there, you can then branch out into security. And I don't care what you do in security, whether it's governance, risk, and compliance, or AppSec, or endpoint engineering, or your detection response person. But I encourage people, you know, it's not a bad thing that people want riches and glory and more power to people. I mean, taken far less to motivate some people than that, right? And riches and glory can be a great motivator. But if you are going to go in that direction, recognize the fact that you do need to spend significant time and get technical. Technical is not something you're born with. And I think some people misunderstand that. I'm self-taught. And the internet had a hell of a lot less information out there when I was getting into it. And it is rich with information now, whether it be things like Coursera or just papers that people have put out there. There's tons of things that you can watch, like DEF CON stuff and, you know, all this stuff. And just take advantage of it. Get technical. Learn this stuff. Learn how to program. It's not that hard. And then once you get that, then sort of the world is your oyster, as far as I'm concerned, within the cybersecurity space.
It's amazing. There are so many golden nuggets in this phenomenal. I love it. This is great. Unfortunately, this is all the time we have for the conversation today. This has been such a pleasure, Nat. Thank you so much for being on this podcast.
No, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you for the invite. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to The Future of Application Security. If you've enjoyed this episode or you are new to the show, I'd love to have you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any episode. And if you like the podcast, I'd be grateful if you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening.